The House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development will come to order. Welcome, everyone. Here's the order of the day. We will be making some announcements on several bills first. We are going to carry over HB 2370, 3613, and 3158. And we are not going to be hearing HJR 42. And we are going to go first to HB 3532 and then back to the work session and proceed through what's left in that general order. So with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3532. Zach.
House Bill 3532 just allows worker leasing companies to apply and receive loans or grants from the Boost account.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Mike McLean. I am the state representative for House District 55, which includes all of Crook County, all of Lake County, and large portions of Klamath, Jackson, and Deschutes. I have a constituent, Greg Lambert, who is the owner and runs Mid-Oregon Personnel. And in Crook County, according to Greg, who is very involved in helping those who are unemployed get jobs, the effective rate of unemployment in Crook County has been at or near 20% for 3 years. One of the efforts by the legislature to address the horrific unemployment challenges was the Boost Bill, Building Opportunities for Oregon Small Business Today. And the effect of the Boost Bill, as it was interpreted by the agency, was to exclude worker leasing companies, or in essence staffing companies, so that if a company, for an example, in Bend hires Mid-Oregon personnel to supply it, to take someone who's unemployed and to help them place that person with the Bend company, that Bend company was not applicable for the Boost program. So the incentive, ironically, was to not hire those who were without jobs if they used these staffing companies. That had an effect that I don't think anyone was pleased with. For an example, in the testimony that has been submitted to you already by Greg Lambert of Mid-Oregon Personnel Services, he pointed out that there was a customer who had a company in Central Oregon that had a 50% turnover rate with new hires to 90 days. After they started using Mid-Oregon personnel, that rate fell to 10%. And what they found is that these staffing companies do a very good job of vetting, finding the people who are eager to work, matching them with a place where they fit, and getting people who are unemployed back to work. The Boost program is about that, and to have an unintended consequence work in the inverse in the highest unemployed area in the state was certainly not what the legislature intended in the previous session. So Greg Lambert has asked me to introduce a bill. I did, and I'm in agreement with him, 3532. There is an amendment that's been proposed as well, and to strike lines 19 through 24 because it is not the staffing company that is the applicant. It's still the, and that was some legislative drafting mistake, but the issue is addressed by the change in lines 12 through 14 on page 1 of House Bill 3532. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the committee's review of this, and I would be eager to answer any questions and to see this get to the floor of the House.
Thank you. Are there questions for the representative? Yes, Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was trying to find it here. I couldn't find it, but the poor results of Boost just hasn't worked. Can you comment on that and why you think these changes would make it work or help it work?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lindsay, I really should not comment out of what I know just in my area of Oregon where I have looked at it. And I think the Boost program, while well-intentioned and having some positive result, did have that one unintended consequence, at least in our area. And it's an easy fix, and I think is eager to be received by the business community. I do understand that there may be similar problems in Washington County or other areas of the state with staffing companies. I'm sure Mr. Lambert would follow up in answering some specific questions about that, because I know he's looked into it. I specifically haven't studied what the data shows in Washington County or elsewhere.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I have no one else signed up for this bill, so unless, does anyone else want to be heard on this bill? Seeing none, at this point I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3532 and open a work session on 2960. Representative Bailey.
House Bill 2960 just creates the Jobs, Energy, and Schools Fund, also known as Cool Schools.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jules Bailey. I have the honor of representing House District 42 in Inner East Side, Portland. My pleasure to bring to you today an amendment to House Bill 2960 that mirrors the conversation that this committee has had over the course of the last several months and represents the work of enormous number of people, including, obviously, people on this committee. And although I have the opportunity and the honor to sit here before you to present the amendment and to walk through the concept, I would be remiss if I did not acknowledge that this has been a group effort, and I appreciate the leadership of this committee and the governor's office on this program. What I'd like to do is walk you through a very brief overview, PowerPoint, on what is in the Dash 4 amendment and what we're looking at here. The Dash 4 amendment is intended to be a comprehensive amendment that incorporates several of the different concepts that have come forward on how we might make our schools better by making them safer, by reducing transportation costs at schools, and by making them cost less by being more efficient. And I want to stress at the outset, and you'll hear it again during the presentation, we're not creating a new program that has new sources of money in it. We're using existing resources better, and we are not creating a mandate. We are providing a tool to school districts to allow them to be able to get done some of the work that they so desperately need. So just a quick reminder for the committee, why we're doing this, and this really is about saving money to the taxpayers. It's about upgrading infrastructure that is in just dire need of repair. And as the unfortunate events of the last month have shown us, seismic and earthquake safety is more important than ever. And we have to have buildings that will stand up and be safe places for our children. And as the events of the last month have shown us, gas prices are beyond our control and are rising rapidly. And we want to give school districts an ability to mitigate the price impacts of those rising prices so that they can save money and be able to reduce costs. We've seen in for the energy efficiency side of the equation, in a case study of 30 schools, about 33% average direct energy savings, 50% average indirect energy savings, and a 32% average water savings in a lot of these efficiency measures that schools are installing. So this really does present not just a little bit of benefit, but a lot of benefit to these schools when it comes to saving money. Now, the big question, obviously, in this session and for this committee, where does the money to do these upgrades come from? And I want to walk you through a couple of different sources of funding. For earthquake safety, the legislature in the has already authorized for this biennium what are called Article 11M and N, which refers to sections in the Constitution, bonds, which are dedicated to seismic safety. About half of that bond sale has already gone out. Half is scheduled to go out in June. That money is just waiting there for schools to use it. We also are investigating a couple other sources of potentially low-cost loans for seismic upgrades. The opportunity that this presents is that when you go into a building and you open up a wall and you start upgrading the earthquake safety, the seismic safety of the building, you are lowering the cost of getting in and doing some of the energy savings at the same time. So we can piggyback on some of that work to lower the overall cost of both the safety upgrades as well as the energy upgrades. Making this a much more efficient proposal and an opportunity and a unique time to do it. For the energy side of the equation, unfortunately, we are running off the screen here. Looks like I made my slide too big. But for the energy side of the equation, we're looking at a program built on the backbone of the small-scale energy loan program. Now, $2.5 billion is available in total capacity through the small-scale energy loan program. We're envisioning something far less than that to give you an idea of scale. Just in sort of the normal course of operations, the department authorized in the last biennium about $200 million out of that. So what we're looking at in terms of SELP money is right in line with sort of normal operations for the SELP program. I'd also like to emphasize again that the SELP program is a unique form of bonding because it does not impact the state's credit rating, it is not supported by the general fund, and it does not cost taxpayers any money. It has its own reserve fund that's attached to it, so it does not count against the state's debt limit, and it's used exclusively for energy projects. So it couldn't be used for anything that's non-energy. Add to that the QECB program, the Qualified Energy Conservation Bond program, which was a federal program authorized under the Stimulus Act. It really is a use-it-or-lose-it allocation that provides a discount on those SELP loans. And then in investor-owned utility territory, there is the public purpose charge, or sometimes called 1149 money, that's directed to schools. The 10% is already going there. That's about $16 million a biennium, and there's about $15 million already sitting there unspent. That's a revenue stream, and we can use that stream to help leverage additional dollars out of SELP. The key here is that for a lot of school districts, not every school district, but for a lot of school districts, this is money that isn't otherwise very useful to them because the costs of what they need to accomplish overwhelm the streams that stream of dollars that's coming into the school. So by combining SELP and this public purpose charge money, we're able to bring down the cost of the loan and allow schools to be able to pay back that loan at what it will in many cases be a 0% interest rate. And then in consumer utility territory, at the bottom there it's cut off, but there is some residual lottery money left in the EAST program in the loan offset grant account. It's about $1.5 million, and that money can get redirected to support small-scale energy loan program in consumer and utility territory. So I'm going to walk you through a relatively Byzantine diagram, but I'm going to take it slowly in stages so we can see exactly how these pieces fit together. So we've got investor-owned utility territory schools and consumer-owned utility territory schools, which is hard to say many times over. But these get treated differently because of the difference in the public purpose charge. And you'll note that the resources available for one aren't necessarily available for the other, which makes structuring any bill like this challenging, although I would submit that that's a conversation for another time. So in each of these territories, we have available what we called before these 11M and N bonds for earthquake safety, for seismic safety, and these are already getting used statewide. add to that these other loan funds that we're looking at, you really have the core, the backbone of the earthquake program. The E should be up on quake. I did this on Keynote, and it doesn't translate to PowerPoint, apparently. For the energy side of the equation, you have the public purpose charge going to schools in investor-owned utility territory, and the East Lottery money going to schools in consumer-owned utility territory. That's already going there now, potentially. And then you have the SILP program, which we discussed as a loan program. And this is already available to schools in both categories, in both territories. So essentially, what we're looking at is taking, for investor-owned utility territory, the public purpose charge. It will still go to the schools. We're not taking their public purpose charge money away from them. The way that they opt into the program, again, it's not a mandate, it's an opt-in, is that they can essentially credit that public purpose charge revenue back to the SELP account, and the SELP account then it helps bring down the cost of that SELP loan that's already brought down by the QECB program. That's why the arrows between public purpose charge and SELP and East Lottery money and SELP are in dotted lines, because it's more of an indirect path to there through the schools. So at the end of the day, what you're looking at are low interest to zero interest loans to these schools to perform these upgrades, combining both earthquake safety and energy retrofits. Now, what I think really makes this exciting is that this same financing mechanism is useful to help schools upgrade their fleets. And the cost of natural gas for buses and other forms of fuel is significantly lower than the petroleum costs that they have now, allowing schools to retrofit and see an immediate cost savings should they choose to in that program. And that's really the energy portion. So a couple of benefits of this structure. It is really a safety-first structure to help improve safer learning environments. It really is about lower cost operations, especially for transportation costs in rural school districts where they have to drive a long way. There's energy savings and lower utility bills. Again, there's no mandate here. And it really uses existing resources better. There's no new sources of money on the table here. Other provisions within the bill, there is a prioritization around schools that are going to include biomass-fired boilers in their retrofits. These are clean-burning sources of fuel that promote local energy and local jobs. There's been great success with those in the Enterprise School District, and for communities where that makes sense, it seems to be working very well. We're looking at energy management plans that ensure that we're not just going to make these changes and walk away, but actually to manage the energy better. Fire code upgrades, certainty that we're going to meet quality standards, a statewide coordination role, and then this study to look at how we can better change the energy that we save to count it more like the energy we generate. And that really is, in my mind, the next step and the next generation of where we need to go on investments, and especially private investment in energy efficiency. So that's what you have before you today. You should have a Dash 4 amendment in front of you. I at the risk of going too long, but because it is complicated and it's before you for the first time, I just want to walk you through it very, very briefly. Section 1 sets up the fund accounts, including the Clean Energy Deployment Fund. Section 2 sets up the program and the contracting for the program. Section 3 is really where the meat of the financing is, and you'll see the weatherization, you'll see the seismic, you'll see the school bus fleets in there, and the different sources of money that I just walked through. Section 4 is policy-wise perhaps the most interesting section. Section 4 is where you get into the prioritization and the criteria around those retrofits. That's where you get into things like the school bus fleet retrofits, where you get into the biomass-fired boilers, where you get into site overlap with seismic and earthquake safety upgrades, where you get into fire life safety codes. So that really has some things that say, again, this is a voluntary program. We're not requiring any piece here, but schools that are including these kinds of things get to go to the front of the line because they're important for the program. Section 6 gets into the report on energy efficiency, counting that more generation more like, or excuse me, energy saved more like generation, sometimes called an efficiency power purchase agreement. Section 8 gets into quality standards. If we were to use 11P bonds in the future, I want to be clear that we're not using 11P general obligation bonds in the Cool Schools program. Section 9 deals with changing the loan offset grant fund and connecting it to the clean energy deployment account. Section 10 redirects the public purpose charge revenue to school districts instead of ESDs. And then we have a number of other conforming clauses in there. So I'm happy to take any questions. I know it's a lot to process and digest. I did bring a whiteboard in case you really are a glutton for punishment. It's over there. And happy to get into any details you want to get into.
Thank you. Are there questions for Representative Bailey? Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for coming in here today. First of all, is there a fiscal statement, revenue impact statement for this dash four?
Co-Chair Benz, Representative Lindsay, great question. Because this is fairly hot off the presses, the dash four, we do not have a fiscal impact or revenue impact statement on it. The next stop for this bill, once the paperwork is ready, and I believe it's not ready for today, is Ways and Means, because obviously that will be a very important part of the discussion.
Follow-up is going back to your diagram and the flow chart. I saw the EESP, which is the Energy Efficient Schools Program, and we have the QECBs, and then the EEAST, and then this would be, it seems to me that we'd be throwing one more layer, I guess, above or completely around the QECB, which would be the Clean Energy Deployment Fund. It seems to me this is just adding one more layer to, frankly, a messy flow chart already.
Co-Chair Benz, Representative Lindsay, I apologize for my graphic skills. I don't think that it is actually all that complicated. The QECB program is actually not a layer. I tried to think about how best to represent this. It's like a discount. It's like a coupon on SELP that we can just apply in the process of getting these loans. The school district doesn't have to navigate any details in the QECB program. It's just a discount on that SELP loan that they get. And all of this is pretty easy to handle. The Clean Energy Deployment Account, but you bring up a good question. The Clean Energy Deployment Account doesn't have a source of funding in it. It's what it does is it simply creates an empty loan fund. If we find other dollars that we can loan to schools, so for example, it's got receipts authority for private dollars. So for example, patient capital investor thinks, hey, this is a great deal to make a loan to schools for energy efficiency. There's a mechanism by which to do that. But it doesn't actually get involved in this Cool Schools program. It's just an empty account with receipts authority.
Follow-up?
One more follow-up. Can you, so let's call it the Cool Schools program. How would we implement that on that diagram?
So, again, as messy as that is, Co-Chair Benz, Representative Lindsay, that is the Cool Schools program. So what it would look like on the ground is your school district, let's say investor-owned utility territory, because that's where I represent, so it's the area I'm most familiar with. I'm a school district. I go to the department. The Department of Energy is already working with schools through the 1149 for Schools program, through the Public Purpose Charge program. So they've already got this relationship established with the schools around that program. So now the department goes to them and says, "Hey, here's a better way that you could use your dollars that you're getting through this public purpose charge revenue that's just sitting there because the costs of whatever you need to do is more than the stream of dollars that you have coming in. So here's a loan that we can offer you, and if you accept this loan, all you need to do is credit that 1149 money, that stream, back to the department to help take care of that loan obligation." And then what they're able to walk through with the school is what the terms of that loan will be. It'll be individualized by school, but in most cases it'll be a zero interest loan. So for a school it should be extremely easy. It's through existing channels that they're already used to dealing with.
And then finally, is what would be the term of the loan be?
Typically for SELP loans, they tend to be in the 12 to 15 year range. Could be up to the district, though, to structure it how they want.
Further questions? President Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bailey, I can tell you've put a lot of time into this and a lot of thought. and I admire what you're doing here. But I'm sitting here thinking about it, and one of the problems that we're facing with our schools is you're asking them, or they get a loan essentially, and they can't afford to pay the loans right now because they can't afford to keep teachers in the classroom. So I'm just trying to see the upside for this. To me, it seems like we should be looking at a way to set up a grant program, or when we're doing our funding, setting up a program where a certain percentage goes into savings accounts for maintenance for the schools. So when they start doing retrofitting and upgrading, there's just money there to take care of the issue. To me, that would be the proper way to do it, rather than asking them to borrow money that they have to pay back and then hit their budget hard again. So I'm just kind of wondering if you've looked into any options like that, and because now would be the time for us to set something up like that while the economy is low. That way, when things start picking up, we just don't throw all this money at the districts. We actually start putting away money to help them with this type of problem.
Co-Chair Benz, Representative Widener, that's a great question, actually. And so, yes, we have looked at why loans versus grants and that sort of thing. We have this stream of dollars through the $1149 dollars going to schools in public purpose charge territory, and what that's shown is that relatively small stream of dollars hasn't been adequate to address a lot of the needs that are there. The great thing about energy efficiency in particular is that it pays for itself over time, and it would pay for itself even if you had a nominal interest rate on it. But at a 0% loan especially, you have a very, very, very fast payback. And so what we have here are different pots of money, so that we're not taking dollars out of the classroom to pay back a loan for energy upgrades. These are very specific to the energy and the operations of the school. So we're not saying to the schools, on the one hand, we're going to give you a loan, but we're not giving you the money out of general fund to pay it back. It doesn't quite work that way. So what we're able to do then is offer this very cost-effective loan to them that recognizes that energy efficiency pays for itself, and that loan is combined with grants. So the 1149 is essentially a grant. The Article 11 M and N for the safety and earthquake upgrades are grants, because obviously that doesn't have a payment stream. So we're bringing in a lot of grant money into this that then makes that loan a really, really good deal for districts. Now, to your point, if a district looks at this and says, gosh, you know, even given all of that, it's not a good deal for us and we can't do it, then they don't have to do it. We're not asking them to take it on. But for a lot of districts, it will make sense, and we've heard from them that they want to do it. But I don't disagree with you at all that we need to be putting a lot more investment and a lot more money into these schools. This is just a first step and helps get some of those schools that are looking for this option in line to be able to do it. And it is fully my intention to innovate on programs that would provide a much greater upfront investment to allow these schools to do those retrofits. I'm completely with you on that.
Representative Lindsay.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question just sparked another question in my mind, and that is, the argument is that we would be paying for these loans with the cost savings that we would have on retrofitting. Just let you in my personal life a little bit. We're refinancing our home right now, and with the refinance, I think our mortgage is going to be $350 or $400 less a month. Where I want to just put that money straight, just continue paying the current monthly mortgage to pay down my principal sooner. My wife wants to buy a minivan with the money that we're going to be saving. That's a personal interest that we're going to have to figure out. My question is what guarantee is there that the schools, what check is there on the schools that they will not go ahead and spend that extra money that they're getting for that cost saving on something else, as opposed to paying it directly on that loan? What guarantee is there?
Co-Chair Benz, Representative Lindsay. Well, they will. In answer to your question, they will have a loan obligation that they have to meet, and school districts are then going to be taking a look at exactly the discussion that you're having with your wife on principal versus interest and how quickly you pay it off. But they will have a set loan schedule that they'll need to meet. Now, again, that'll be a 0% or close to 0% loan to those districts. So we have a very high degree of confidence that that savings is there, sufficient in any number of scenarios to make that pencil and more. In fact, there should hopefully be some money left over afterwards. But, Mr. Co-Chair, I know you have some other questions on your committee, but I would also mention that we have some folks who specialize in efficiency from Geldwind in the audience who can perhaps talk a little bit more about the benefits that efficiency provides and how cost-effective it is in paying for itself.
Yes, Representative Fire.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Bailey. I know we've talked a little bit, and I guess I'm still, you know, it's a very complicated process. Plus, then we're adding a number of new new funds on top of it in the bill. So, and I'm going to have to look through it. But one question is, I think in the original bill, you were removing the statutory limitation from the ESA fund? And is that in this amendment?
Co-Chair Bentz, Representative Beyer, let me take both your questions, or your statement first and your question second. In response to the implication that perhaps we're creating lots of new funds in this bill, I would respectfully say that actually we're only creating one new fund, and that's the Clean Energy Deployment Fund, and it has no dollars in it and is not part of this financing structure. Every other source of funds here is something that already exists and money that's already available, and we're combining it to work better together. In response to your question around the ESA, we are doing nothing to change the limit on the ESA in this bill. There is a provision within the bill that addresses that we heard from the department that in order to use the loan offset grant fund, which is part of the EAST program, that in order to bring that money in, they had a limitation on using that for that EAST program. So all it does is change the provision around the EAST program specifically. It does not change the amount of the ESA or the cap.
Carson, thank you very much. Representative, I see you have two invitees, Michelle Holly and Beth Slater, if they could come up. And those are the only folks we're inviting to speak thus far. Did you want to stay, Representative? Or?
Sure.
And not to hurry you too much, but please keep it fairly to the point. In fact, a lot to the point, if you don't mind. Thanks.
Co-Chair Bentz, Co-Chair Reed, who's not here, members of the committee. I'm Beth Slater. I work with CFM Strategic Communications, speaking to you today on behalf of our client, Geldwind. Geldwind's been involved in talking about energy efficiency for the better part of a couple of years now. They've met with legislators in the interim, they've met with the governor in the interim, and they're very interested in efforts around energy efficiency, especially cool schools. And Michelle Halley here from Geldwind is going to talk to you a little bit more about what they think about all this energy efficiency stuff.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Bentz, members of the committee. My name is Michelle Halley, and I'm an External Affairs Manager with Geldwind in our office in Portland. First, I'd like to thank Co-Chairs Reed and Bentz and the members of the committee for giving me the opportunity to provide my comments on HB 2960 today. As many of you already know, Geldwind is the world's largest manufacturer of windows and doors, and we are based in Klamath Falls. Geldwind has been in the energy efficiency business for over 50 years, and we applaud the governor's and the legislature's efforts and focus on making K-12 school buildings across the state more energy efficient. And, of course, being in the window and door business and having lots of experience supplying doors and windows to new school construction and school retrofit projects, we would welcome the opportunity to be able to compete for the window and door business from these projects. However, I am not here today to sell you doors and windows. I am here to sell you on the idea that retrofitting school buildings to make them more energy efficient is not just good for the environment, but it is good for the state's economy. K-12 public school buildings are just that, public buildings where taxpayer money is used to maintain the building and pay the utility bills. In an era of highly constrained budgets, why would it make sense to pay more for heating and lighting on a continuous, unending basis than you absolutely have to? Making the necessary investments up front to, quote, button up these buildings, unquote, will have several immediate benefits. Number one, saving taxpayer money on utility bills. Number two, increasing occupant comfort. The kid sitting next to a drafty old single-pane window in the middle of winter is thinking about how cold she is. She's not thinking about that math problem on the test in front of her. Teachers and staff in the building may crank up the thermostat or use space heaters, although probably not allowed, to keep warm, driving up heating bills and possibly presenting a fire hazard in the building. Number three, creating jobs. If, for example, one of the energy efficiency upgrades to a school building were to be window replacement, jobs would be created to manufacture those windows, transport those windows, sell those windows, and install those windows. In the case of Jeldwin, all of those windows would be manufactured in Oregon by Oregonians, transported by Oregonians, and installed by Oregonians. The environmental benefits are obvious. The downstream economic benefits would be significant. Is HB 2960 perfect? No, but it is a very good start towards making an investment in our school buildings that will save money, help students, reduce energy usage, and create jobs. In conclusion, I would like just to point out that 40% of all the energy used in this country is consumed by buildings. Energy efficiency is not just a feel-good initiative, but instead deserves serious consideration in the broad energy policy debate. Real energy efficiency improvements to schools or homes or office buildings have real and measurable financial impacts. These impacts are further detailed in a white paper Jeldwin has drafted and which I would like to submit for the record. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for Representative Lindsay?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not a question, just a statement. Say hello to Ron Saxon for me.
I will, Representative. Thank you.
Actually, a question. Has the President of the United States implemented the idea that Mr. Saxon took to him on the...
He's trying, but he's having a problem with Congress.
And I'm sure it has something to do with school insulation, doesn't it, Representative Lindsay? Thank you so much for your testimony.
Yeah.
I see no other questions. Representative Bailey, we're going to wait for our co-chair to come back before we address your amendment. And I have no one else signed up, in fact, or invited today. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And with that, we're going to wonder where our co-chair is.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Do we is what we're waiting for to make sure we have the proper number of votes cast? Is what we don't want him to not be wrong to take the vote, or do you need to check in with him?
I think if someone would like to make the motion for the dash fours, that would be worthwhile at this point.
Yeah, I'd like to move the dash four amendments into the bill.
The dash four amendments dated 4/13/11 have been moved. Is there discussion? Hearing none, is there objection? Seeing none, the dash four amendments are adopted. And with that, I'm going to close the work session on HB 2960 and carry HB 2960 over to our next meeting, which is Friday. And with that, I am going to open a work session on House Bill 173. And see, we don't have an amendment on that, do we? I think we're going to I'm going to go into recess. Take a recess for 5 minutes.
Say again, what?
going to close the work session for the moment on House Bill 3173, and if Representative Smith is ready, we will open the work session on HB 2891.
House Bill 2891, as introduced, requires the Tri-County Metropolitan Transportation District to sponsor and support the establishment of community-based initiative to provide voluntary transit foot patrols. We do have a number of amendments that changes that.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jefferson Smith, representing District 47 in the Oregon House. Some of you might remember from last session we did a bill, not entirely unrelated, that passed with 50-plus votes on the House floor to try to address a relatively significant challenge that my constituents face. And it's not limited to my constituents, but my constituents face of probably a disproportionate share of the brunt. And that is making our local MAX line feel like a stronger community asset. You may have seen the recent Oregonian headline, which may have been the headline may have been a selling papers headline, but it did have some data that was important, which is that after some trend of decreasing criminal incidents on the MAX line recently, that trend has reversed and in other places at least flattened. That is, for people in my district, a real significant issue. In fact, in knocking on lots and lots of doors in my district, it came up a lot of times. In fact, I can't remember a single time when we started talking about transportation that somebody didn't bring it up and mention a complaint or a fear, saying they wouldn't want their daughter to ride, wouldn't want their wife to ride, wouldn't themselves want to ride. I think some of that, and said it then and we'll say it now, I think some of that is overblown. I have myself never felt unsafe on the MAX line and urge other people not to feel unsafe also. I recognize that I'm, you know, nearly 6'4 and 250 pounds, right? I don't like to acknowledge that. I'm trying to work on it. And so it's different. And I also know that a criminal incident on the MAX line tends to get disproportionate attention and press. Right? So I don't want to add to a hysteria that is undeserved or make an impression to the extent that it's exaggerated even more so. I do want to be responsive to a district concern, a community concern, and see what we can do. There are, since we started addressing this really 2 years ago, we've looked at various options. And there are several different options that one might consider if one wanted to increase the safety and increase the sort of welcoming nature of the MAX line. One would be to increase police presence. I think there's no probably replacement for that in terms of criminal incidents. And two police officers with training and equipment and benefits is about $250,000, right? So it is, so to get eight of them, just to get two per platform on four platforms is really expensive. It is an expensive proposition. Another thing you do is you can close the system. I don't mean shut it down, but rather make it so you can't get in there without without going through a turnstile. This is something that various members of law enforcement have proposed. It is a pretty controversial thing, relatively expensive thing. Some of the platforms as they exist couldn't exist as they exist with a turnstile system because they were sort of built with an idea of being an open system. And there are other ideas. We have one according to the first law of legislative absurdity, thermodynamics, by which the attention an issue receives is disproportionately related to its importance. You may have seen one of the ideas that has come out from some of our constituents, which is doing, as they've done in some other parts of the world, of playing playing music on the MAX line, and a short pilot showed a 41% decrease in calls for service on the area tested. This bill tries a different idea. This bill takes two ideas and combines them. And it came from, and I'll bring up the members of the community who've been involved in these discussions and formed an organization called Max Action to start addressing this, not limited to how do we make, try not to be oppositional or negative, not how can we make, how do we make MaxLine less dangerous, but how do we make it a better, stronger community asset? And they took two ideas and said, what if you combine these things? One, like a neighborhood watch. And two, like an adopt-a-highway. And what would it look like if those two things sort of came together and you could have community groups that would adopt a MAX platform and its surrounding area and develop a set of standards for what that, and might be even informal ones, for how often it would be cleaned, for what that would mean. In the same way we've done with highways, it would need to be a little more robust because you'd also have sort of the neighborhood watch component. On the other hand, there's far fewer of these stops, and at least give it a try and allow it to get started. So that's where we are, and to put this idea out and open to amendments. And most interested in I am most interested, at least, in hearing from the community members who have come from a greater distance. But happy to answer questions if members of the committee have them.
Questions from the committee. Representative Sheehan, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, I did.
Okay, I think you moved it just slightly before the co-chair. So
thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a couple of questions here. fare compliance is a big part of crime not being present on the train.
Yep.
Do you plan on this having some sort of monitoring for fare compliance, or is this just crime that you're looking to?
So I would definitely, let me say, even by saying it's not just crime, I then, sort of don't think of a tree, right? You end up thinking about a tree. Absolutely not just crime. In fact, our idea going from jump was if we could do more to make people comply with their fares, there would be less. That would be a cheaper mechanism than a pair of uniformed police officers. I'm not saying it wouldn't be nice to have both. But another idea is that we have floated. Actually, put it. I don't know if we put in the bill. We did put in the bill this year. Was for visible ticketing, and so that instead of just printing out. Oh, in fact, you and I think spoke about that. Instead of just printing out a ticket that you put in your pocket, and sometimes the machine doesn't work. When it comes time to replace the machines, look into replacing them with a machine that could spit out a lanyard or a sticker, or even just to have you hold it in your hand. So if you're a TriMet safety officer, or if you're, somebody with an Adopt-a-Stop program, or if you're a fellow rider, you wouldn't, age profile or noise profile or racially profile. You could ticket profile. Who's got a ticket? And approach the people who weren't. And I still think that's a really intriguing idea and would like us to continue to consider it. In terms of how, I don't imagine you'd have citizen volunteers saying, hey, you, did you pay? I do think you could have citizen volunteers who, sort of foot patrollers, neighborhood watch type people, who could say, hey, the machine's not working, we're going to call. Right, who could say, who could be there as a presence, creating sort of a mild peer pressure effect to make it more likely that people would pay. From every study, sort of broken windows theory stuff, just by everything we know about kind of cultural impacts on public safety behavior, we know that that kind of stuff matters. Environmental impacts can matter. So I do think it might have a bigger impact on fare compliance, or I should say a more direct impact on fare compliance than it had directly on crime. But hopefully it's about making the platform areas the kind of environments we want it to be.
Quick follow-up.
Sure.
Thank you. Representative, in our districts actually are connected by the Green Line, and I'm a little concerned about one thing, and maybe you can speak to it. I was talking with the undersheriff the other day for Clackamas County, and he mentioned that we've got a really big heroin problem that is at the Clackamas Town Center, where kids are going to the town center, they're stealing designer jeans and things like that. They're getting on the train at the town center, and they're going up just a couple of stops to Johnson Creek, and they're selling that, they're trading it for heroin. That surprised me that we had heroin that close into suburban neighborhoods. And your bill here refers to volunteers at least 12 years of age and be registered with the Adopt-a-Stop coordinator. I'm concerned that if you had a 12-year-old on a train that wasn't properly trained to deal with something, does this put kids in harm's way if they see a drug deal going on? I'm just concerned that would this cause
good
that?
Point.
Do you have data about whether this has happened elsewhere in places where you have guardian angels? Or where is the number 12, I think, is the...
Because 12, because 11 seemed too young.
My
no magic age. I don't mean to treat it cavalierly. That was a little funny. I would answer a few ways. First of all, happy to do an amendment that would change the age. Second, happy to do an amendment that would say only with an adult. We have recognized that with Max Action, as the people here can testify to if they choose. There have been two events that have happened, one where we went out and did a survey of Max riders, and another where we went and did a cleanup. And there was real interest in young people participating. It was always with an adult, but it was interest in young people participating. So even, I guess, our intent at the time of drafting was, even an 11-year-old with their parent, you know, do something different, right? Do something else with your parent that day. But if you're a high school student, or maybe even an older middle school student, you're with your parent, that's cool. The last thing I would say, my knee-jerk would be to say that kind of thing would happen in implementation. I think we have an amendment that even takes a lot of those details out, but we've got no particular interest in having really little kids alone approaching drug dealers, and that's not only not the intent of the bill, I think would be very careful to make sure that wasn't the impact of the bill.
A very, very fast follow-up. Did you have data on crimes that are committed against people that are volunteers in these sort of capacities?
We don't. We could get something maybe from the neighborhood office the Office of Neighborhood Involvement with neighborhood watches. This would be a very different thing than, say, a guardian angel, right? Where a guardian angel is there to confront, right? And we wouldn't have folks who are there to confront. Right, we would be there to have folks who would clean up and maybe welcome and maybe report, right? But not to confront. And so and from what I've in talking to law enforcement, and I don't have the quick answer to your questions. I don't have data. In talking to law enforcement, we have not heard significant concern about behavior that is not confrontational behavior, and which is why anyway we don't want to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was struck by your mention of the classical music at stuff. Didn't you have a bill on that?
I don't recall, Mr. Chair. There was discussions in the interim about that, and that's what I remember about that. I remember that on April 1st, somebody had, I think, mistakenly posted a bill that sounded similar to the one you're discussing. I don't know what happened to that bill.
I think there was some representative who asked us to take it off the agenda. But if that bill had gone forward, what would be the appropriate music to play?
Mr. Co-Chair, Rachmaninoff, I think. There's been various studies done about the most appropriate music, and they found that Brahms is not as quite as impactful as Bach, and I think that's the correct pronunciation. And Beethoven's about in between. And those are, I think, the only four classical music people I know. I even call them classical music people. They're called composers.
Maybe a Rickroll.
Yeah, exactly. Rick Astley, I think, is another composer that has
sure
high.
Thank you.
Thank you. Colleagues.
It's more viral.
As long as it's got nothing to do with classical music.
Doesn't.
President Lindsay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad that you brought, Representative Smith, I'm glad you brought up the broken windows theory. I haven't been able to wrap my brain around this either. I've visited hundreds of metros in Europe and Asia, and most of them have that entrance. And I think that this idea of having a foot patrol or some sort of entrance welcoming committee may be helpful. But I think I'm just always inclined to just get some troopers on there, real troopers. And the reason why I say that is I've worked downtown Portland for, I don't know, 6-7 years and done the max, and I literally have seen two policemen in a span of 3 years. I'm on the west side. But whatever that's worth, I think kind of having a welcoming committee and more foot patrol is a good start.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, first of all, not only yes, but heck yes. I absolutely agree that, if there were a bill offering a choice, that choice to me wouldn't be a very hard one. I do think there is some value in a both-and strategy. We have seen what's happened with our number of uniformed police officers. I would be sort of a member of a team that would say, hey, let's boost that, and have been and have suggested it. Something else facing our district, and it's a rare occasion that I try to, I think any of us try to impose what's happening very locally in our district upon this chamber. And this is one of the rare occasions when I am attempting some degree of that imposition. We have a significant need to engage more people in the community around the community's most important challenges, a significant need. From church infrastructure to school infrastructure, with as much demographic change as that has happened, there. What I have heard from community members is that some of the desire to do this would be, in fact, to help build a little bit of energy so that if they wanted to approach the various budgeteers, there would be a crew that could say, hey, like the Max Action Group could say, hey, we want some more uniformed police officers. And that I think there could be some value from the civic engagement in multiple ways, including uniformed police officer requests, and don't mean it at all, quite the contrary, to be instead of that.
Representative Byer.
Thank you, and I know you want to get moving, but I will thank you. This amendment is a much quicker read than the last one we had. So I actually got to read the whole thing today. My hackles did raise on the age.
Yeah.
Concern for me. The other thing, and this is not to imply that the system is unsafe everywhere, I would be very concerned, because it doesn't say that you have to work in pairs or multiples or anything else, but I would be real concerned about a volunteer out on their own. So that's just my little feedback.
I agree with you, and I think that TriMet's preference was to, or, you know, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Byer, I think TriMet's preference was to address some of those details by way of implementation rather than the more blunt cudgel of a bill. I think pairs are, you know, way better as well, and whether it's for somebody younger or somebody not younger, when we have done when Max Action has done the activities it's done, it's always been in little groups. And luckily, because we're talking about, you know, relatively bounded areas, you know, like a small handful of platforms, we wouldn't even go with two, right? I mean, usually you go with a little bigger group than two, you know, two or four, or even more. So I agree with that, and hopefully with that and legislative record, that would help any implementation that happens.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And there are some constituents.
Yes, there are. My co-vice chair, Byer, informs me that I may have made a procedural error in opening a work session on this rather than a public hearing. And therefore, I'm going to, if I did open it, close the work session and open a public hearing, or reopen, as the case may be, on the bill we've been listening to thus far, which is House Bill 2891, and call up Kim Breckel, Mike Vanderveen, and Tom Lewis.
Hello, Chair Bentz, Co-Chair Bentz, and members of the committee. My name is Kim Breckel, and I am a community member of East Portland. I've been involved in a bunch of different community activities, and recently have more focused into Max Action, which is a subcommittee of East Portland Action Plan. The group is a group kind of in transition, so we're building more and more community involvement as we go along. We have several local community members involved, and we have apartment owners, a lot of different vested people interested in this. I guess I want to turn this a little bit away from the foot patrols and the enforcement issue. I, as a community member, think that some of the, not all, but a big percentage of the max danger is more of a perception, and it continues to get attention versus what the reality is. I'm a handicapped person. I'm disabled. I often use a wheelchair, and I use the max, and I don't feel in danger when I use it. I have seen elements of drug deals and other things that have gone on, but I would say that's exception versus the rule for my experience on the max. And so based on that, as a community member that will tend to be in need of the max more and more down the road as I lose my ability to walk, which is not a sympathy vote, but just simply a statement, is that I want it to be friendly and user-friendly. I'm a grandparent as well, and I want my grandchildren to be able to be with me and be safe. And so part of how I see that and how I see Max Action doing that is that by this bill, allowing community members to form groups that can do much like the highway, adopt a stop, and actually adopt an area. And when I say a group, any community activity I've ever done has been with two or more. We never do anything alone for safety issues. Not in physical harm, but even lifting or slipping or falling or anything, you want to make sure you have another party there so someone could call for help. You can endanger yourself really quickly. One of the things we're not advocating is being on the max line at all. We're hoping that with this process that this will be a very low financial impact to TriMet. Based on, we're really not asking them for anything except for acknowledgement of the groups that would come and adopt the stop. I personally don't see why there should have to be a whole position for this. There are community members that are more than willing to step up to the plate and run an adopt-a-stop program and do that for the whole MAC system, not just East Portland. I know I would be interested. It's a opportunity for different groups to get together and take ownership of their individual stations. And one of the ways of doing that is I recently organized the spring break cleanup, and we had 26 community members out there. We collected over 1,600 pounds worth of trash along the MAX line, so we could definitely do community cleanups. We used Solve, another well-established Oregon group that gave us all the equipment and are more than willing to work with us again. We have our own vest. We have our own grippers. Those are for safety issues. I would like to see it where maybe down the road we could put bulletin boards up at the different MAX areas that would express what's going on in that neighborhood. I'm a member of a local church very close to the 148th stop. We'd like to start a farmer's market, and so we'd like to be able to advertise that. At this point, there isn't a whole lot stopping us from doing some of this, but we want to work in unison with TriMet. We don't want to overstep, and so we figure if we set up the boundaries now, that we'll have a positive relationship going into it right from the get-go, and we'll all be talking on the same page.
Thank you. Which one would you like to go next?
Sure. Co-Chair Benz and committee. I'm Tom Lewis. I'm with Centennial Community Association, and we are go out to our community is towards from 148th to 162nd, and we're just south of the MAX line to Stark, but the impact on our community is a great asset. Use the MAX for, since we're basically a residential neighborhoods that have to travel outside for work, use the MAX quite regularly. I would say that the MAX in our area is unique to what had been the initial MAX line for Portland and to Gresham as the eastern end, and that it, in its initial phase, was built with a lot of study, I'm sure, but was set up differently than the rest of the MAX system with travels along highways and other parts of the city that are just not similar to what we're dealing with in our neighborhoods. And so given that it's a great system and about 40 years old, it needs that special attention of citizen input, along with what MAX is able to do with their maintenance and security staffs,
And we're willing to step up and make it a usable asset in our community to the best that it can be. And we're putting on the line ourselves to see that that can happen. And that's what I'd like to say.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Mike Vanderveen. Coach Hare Reed and Coach Hare Benz and the committee, thank you so much for spending time on this. It's a really interesting setting because a lot of our conversation is about a fairly local area. That's where we're started, and the fact that the TriMet board is appointed by the governor brings us to the state. So it's a really interesting conversation. Just want to reinforce that we, as the Max Action Subcommittee of the East Portland Action Plan, are a really, really cooperative group. I recently completed 2 years of AmeriCorps service in the area, and so got to know a lot of the folks in the community and heard just so much about the MAX. My focus was on listening and understanding what the community wanted to do to come around and make it a better place to live. And it's a very much a shoulder community. It's on the edge of the city of Portland, as Tom was describing, and into Gresham, and it's on the edge of three different school districts. It's on the edge of different representative districts, and it's just a border area that we're starting in. But what we're talking about has an impact for the whole system wide. So we were very happy to partner with TriMet very closely to do the actions that we've done so far. We had, when we were surveying members on five platforms along the blue line, there was a TriMet representative on each platform, and everyone that was involved was trained by TriMet folks in terms of how to conduct the survey on the platforms. And that was a great partnership, and I think it would be really healthy for us to move forward in a way that TriMet establishes ways to regularly work with community members. And this is one of those ways that we can do that. We can establish adopt-a-stop groups. So we are currently partnered with Multnomah Youth Commission, the Office of Youth Gang Violence Prevention, the Portland Office of Neighborhood Involvement Crime Prevention Group, many apartment complex managers, TriMet, Portland Police, the Transit Police, Gresham Police, Impact Northwest, the Rosewood Initiative, which is a partnership between Portland and Gresham Police. So we're very, very cooperative and open with who we're working with. So thank you so much for your time on this, and just really appreciate your position in taking a statewide look at how we can have a really immediate impact.
Well, thank you for driving down here today. It's a drive. Are there questions for this panel?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say thank you guys a lot for coming down, and these are some of the really most valuable citizens in our neighborhoods and have been doing really, really great work. And thanks for coming to your building.
Thank you very much. And we have one more person signed up to testify, Aaron Dees from TriMet. So, Aaron, you want to come up?
Good afternoon. Co-chairs Benson Reed, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Dees. I'm with TriMet Office of Government Affairs. Thanks for the opportunity to speak to this subject. In the interest of time, I'll talk quickly.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate all the work that the community members have done on this. TriMet was approached by Representative Smith at the end of February with the idea of creating an Adopt-a-Stop program for MAX. We have an Adopt-a-Stop program for buses. To just sum it up, we basically work with businesses to enable them to provide a trash can that they clean up, and we provide the trash can, maintain it. It's very informal, and if trash cans stop getting empty, we remove them. At the end of March, we met with Representative Smith and his staff, Alex, and And we had our transit police commander, Krebs, and our executive director of operations to discuss this issue in more detail. After the meeting, we thought about it for a little bit, and we decided to create a program. We sent the message to Representative Smith last week saying that we are looking at bringing together the key players, including the Office of Neighborhood Involvement, Transit Police Department, and interested in community groups. They'll work together to define the goals, requirements, and parameters of the program. Clearly, we are concerned about putting requirements into the statute that we need to have worked out with the members who are affected by it. So we've agreed to do this. Our goal is to do a pilot project of between 1 and 3 stations, depending on interest in the community. We know we definitely have some. Be on the east side, Blue Line. End of the year, we'll evaluate how the process has been going, how active folks have been, what the benefits and disadvantages were, and move forward from there. It's something we do on the bus side, and it seems that there are some... A key difference between our bus and our MAX possibilities, though, is that on platforms you have lots of people waiting, you have issues with trains coming and going, you have some liability issues, you have some union issues, various things that need to be worked out. So we would like the flexibility of being able to meet with everybody, have everybody talk about what their issues are, and then move forward with something. But we're committed to that. I've agreed with everything that Representative Smith and the community members have said regarding the if you have more active community members, you have more people out there who have an interest in making this community asset. I think that's a wonderful thing. So
thank you very much. Questions? Representative Smith.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, but thank you. Just want to say thank you on the record to TriMet for working in good faith on this and working with the members of the community looking for solutions. Just want to say thanks a lot.
Further questions? Thank you very much for coming down.
Thank you.
And with that, I'm going to... I see no one else signed up. Does anyone else want to be heard on this bill? Yes. Come on.
Co-Chairs Benson, Reed, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Alex Tinker, aide to Representative Smith. I've been working with the folks here and lots of other folks in the district for over a year now on this issue. I just wanted to say that when I first started working for Representative Smith and became aware of what seemed like an obsession with MAX safety, I thought it was a little bit silly, and I thought it was a little overdone. And I continued to think that until we had our first community meeting, which was very well attended, and then more community meetings, and then an event where we had 3 dozen or more volunteers get surveys from 500-plus people who all said they wanted to be involved in making MAX a more positive community asset. It was absolutely overwhelming to me how salient this issue is in East Portland and how powerful a tool it has been to get people involved in advancing positive solutions for their own communities. With that, I'd also just say that I just got the -3 amendments for this bill. I believe the co-chairs do have it, but we have updated the bill so that in its current form in the -3, it would permit, I believe, almost complete flexibility on the part of TriMet, allow for them to work out the details. The thing about 12-year-olds is no longer in there. We specified that TriMet would set up all appropriate rules for the program and would encourage the members of the committee to consider passing the bill.
Thank you. Questions? Seeing none. Thank you very much. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on 2891. And now, members of the committee, let's go back to the agenda. We're going to work our way down through the work session portion. I'm going to reopen the work session on House Bill 3173. Co-Chair Reed.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3173 to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits with a due pass recommendation.
Co-Chair Reed has moved House Bill 3173 to the floor. No, sorry, state that again.
Mr. Chair, maybe I said it incorrectly. Yeah. What I said was for the Joint Tax Credit Committee, but if it's more appropriate, I could say to the floor for the due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference.
Thank you. Representative Reed has moved House Bill 3173 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and to the Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference. Is there a discussion? Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to mention a couple of things. I'm going to support this, but I do have some concerns, but I just wanted to get out on the record. One is, how often are these used and how much is it really costing us? We have a bit of information, but I think that's why we refer these things to another committee, because they look in even more detail at that. But the other is, as I recall, please correct me if I'm wrong, we considered this with another bill on the same day that was about e-commerce. And I also was wondering to the extent to which we see the combining of this particular enterprise zone benefit with the e-commerce benefit. And I had some questions about e-commerce, but not about this one. So I just wanted to put that on the record.
Thank you, Representative Nathanson. I just mentioned that I contacted my county economic development advisors in the four counties I represent, and surprisingly all responded positively about this particular program. And so that was just a few days ago. So with that in mind, I would encourage moving this to tax credits, and then those folks who have expressed that interest can then appear there, because they certainly didn't appear here before. But they were totally unaware of the sunset or the activity. So that's my reason for supporting, or I will be voting for this. Further thoughts? It's been moved. Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none, the motion is passed, and with that I will close the work session on House Bill 3173 and open a work session on House Bill 3227. Zach.
3227 is the CAPCO creates a Certified Capital Company Act. And I just want to note it is going to tax credits, not revenue.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3227 to the, I guess since it also has prior reference to the floor, without recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference.
Then move that House Bill 3227 be moved to the floor without recommendation, with a subsequent referral to the Committee on Tax Credits.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to speak to my motion on that.
Please.
Thank you. I want to make it very clear for the benefit of the committee that I was intentional in making the motion without recommendation. I think the bill that's before us is not in a form that would deserve passage as it stands right now. However, I've been doing some reading and having some conversations with other states and other folks who have experience with this concept, and I think it does deserve more consideration. I think it has shown significantly positive results in the other places it's been used. Oregon would not be the first to embark on this strategy, and the realities of our calendar make me think it's unlikely that we would be able to complete that work in this committee. So I'd like to see it continue as a possibility in the Joint Tax Credit Committee. I think it might fit well with some of the other things that we're doing and allow us to fund some important economic development work. But at the risk of being repetitive, it's not ready yet. I want the legislature to have the chance to continue working on it.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will support this motion because it's moving it along without recommendation, exactly for the purpose that Representative Reed, our co-chair, explained, that it would need a lot of work. But I did want to say that I've been looking at it, and in addition to some comments that we've seen about its usefulness, I've also read some pretty serious problems that perhaps can be corrected with drafting a bill that is quite different, more constrained, and so forth. But I got some information that was available from Governing Magazine, which is a magazine for state and local officials. I've been reading it for many years. And it's a nonpartisan magazine to just help do public policy analysis and share information. And what I read that was reported from that magazine, it says for they traced $1 billion of insurance company tax credits that states have given to CAPCOs so far. More than half of that $1 billion went to just three corporations. One of those companies, and the name I think is Newtek Wilshire, uses the money to bankroll its own subsidiaries. State reviews of CAPCOs found big problems. Quote, a Colorado audit found that out of $100 million, the CAPCO had invested almost half in low-risk vehicles such as treasury bonds, spent $11 million setting up its offices, and another $4 million on management fees, so that only about a third of the money went for the program's intended purposes, end quote. Well, what that says to me is that there weren't adequate, sometimes we call sideboards. There weren't adequate constraints and definitions and process set up. So maybe these things can work for the intended purpose, and I certainly hope that the next committee figures out how to make business and job opportunities like this work well, and instead of incur this kind of result.
Thank you, Representative. I share many of your concerns, Representative Fire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I also want to go on record. I will support moving this down without recommendation, even though I have made a statement on the record that I'm not. If we aren't ready to make a recommendation, it shouldn't probably be moving. And I'm going to trust the good members, of which our co-chair is one of, to be able. Co-chairs are both members of. That they will do something wonderful with this bill or kill it. So
that'd be our aim.
Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm going to vote no on the motion. I hope we won't, or object to it. I hope we won't move it, and I'll explain why. I won't reiterate the concerns that Representative Nathan shared about CAPCOs. Have yet to, through relatively cursory investigation, see any redeeming social value. And not sure there's anything in this area that needs to be done. And not sure that an amended version of this, even a significantly amended version of this, have not been convinced that that adds any value, or not convinced that it adds any value that something else wouldn't add, such as an amended different bill or an entirely different bill. Another thing I've heard that I agree with is that more real consideration is needed. I would support a motion to refer to the Committee on Revenue without recommendation. I'll explain why. Because that would ensure that it had a policy discussion on the House side and also on the Senate side. If we get it to a joint committee, that will ensure that the only conversation that happens with any significant detail will be in that joint committee prior going to the floor, and so I'm not sure that that's the best way to go. I'm not always opposed to moving a bill along without us really coming to grips with it, but I think we got to find some balance. This misses that. I think if there's something worth doing, we should do that, learn about that, and do that bill. So I'll be voting no on objecting to the motion. Thanks.
Thank you. Further discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Smith?
No.
Representative Nathanson?
Aye.
Representative Lindsay?
No.
Representative Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Beyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan?
Yes.
Chair Reed?
Aye.
Chair Vance?
Aye. The motion passes. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3227 and close the work session on House Bill 3227 and open a work session on House Bill 2329. Zach.
House Bill 2329 is the ATV bill. It alters the definitions of Class 1, 2, and 3 ATV vehicles and also adds a Class 4.
Chair, I think we have the -4s. Move the -4 amendments to House Bill 2329.
Co-Chair Reed has moved the -4 amendments to House Bill 2329, dated April 5th of 2011. Is there discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
met with the parties. I think we still need some more amendments. They agreed to work with me on the Senate side, so I'm kind of acting in good faith here a little bit. But there's some issues I have when I look up the Class C that it went to violation, and I'm looking at it, and I'm not an attorney, so I'm just kind of acting in good faith, but it's reckless driving, and it's a criminal charge, and that's Class A. Class C charge, potential 5 years in prison or $125,000, so I don't think it can fall into that, but the dash fours that I've seen, and I can't get them up on my computer right now to go through it and look at our own statutes, but I want to know what the penalties are, because I agree with we need the new classification of vehicle, but we need to make sure that we're not penalizing somebody when your son goes and jumps in. Oh, thank you, Zach. Jumps in the vehicle and takes off without your permission. All of a sudden, you're facing these stiff penalties. So, and I shared those concerns with them in my office, and they said they'd work with me. The other thing I'd like to see is somebody with disabilities on the board for making these decisions, because we're throwing steering wheel in versus handlebars, and now I could see people cutting off steering wheels, putting handlebars in, and that would make the interior a little more dangerous on a vehicle to get it to fall under a different classification. So people are very smart and creative, and they know how to get around them. If I can figure it out, I'm not the smartest person in the world, and I know how to get around these rules, so trust me, there's people more creative than me and mechanically creative to get around these, to put them in the classification. So with that, if we must move it today before we can drop any other amendments, I will do my best to straighten it out on the other side, but I want my concerns on the record and noted for everybody to hear here. So
thank you, Representative. Further comments? And just as a note, because of the short time we have left to do things in this committee, I think your focus on the Senate is the right focus. So, if there's no further discussion, will the clerk call the roll? These are the amendments.
Representative Widener.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Lindsay.
This was the amendment.
This is the
dash four amendment.
Yeah, didn't you want to vote no?
The dash fours are much better. So I'm a yes on the dash four amendment.
I'm sorry. Forgive me. Please continue.
Representative Lindsay.
Yes.
Representative Nathanson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Beyer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan.
Yes.
Chair Reed.
Aye.
Chair Benz.
Aye. The dash four amendments are adopted. Co-Chair Reed.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2329 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Co-Chair Reed has moved House Bill 2329 to the as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Yep. Mr. Chair, if we may have them come forward and just let us know that they will work to address some of the concerns on the Senate side, I would like to get that on the record if we could.
What they are you
It'd
speaking
be
about?
The department.
Let's talk. I know, but procedurally.
Stand.
Okay. Stand at ease. Discussions are held offline as opposed to bringing folks up this particular part of the process. Is there further discussion?
With that, I'll have to change. I was going to be a yes vote, but I will be a no vote just to make sure the Senate knows where I'm at on this.
That's understandable. Further discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
No.
Representative Nathanson?
Aye.
Representative Lindsay?
Yes.
Vice Chair Chair
Reed? Aye. Chair Vance? Aye. Close the work session on House Bill 2329 as a carrier, Representative Beyer.
Sure.
Yes. As agreed to be the carrier. And
that way you can get it on the record.
With that, I'm going to open the work session on House Bill 3377. Co-chair Reed.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3377 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Co-chair Reed has moved House Bill 3377 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? See none. Is there objection?
I'm sorry, I missed that. Which one?
House Bill 3377.
Should have had Zach say a few words. What? Zach,
tell us about the bill.
House Bill 3377 was just adding the city of Salem to the list of 10 cities eligible to have photo radar.
Representative Weiner.
Mr. Chair, on this one here, I will be a no today. This has been a big issue in other states, other places where it's used. I know we've put safe guards here in Oregon to protect some of the problems that they're facing in other states, but I don't think this is something that the public wants. The public hasn't came in and said, hey, we want photo radar in our neighborhoods. It's the police, and I could see this turning into a revenue-making system and used in an inappropriate way. So I will be a no.
Thank you, Representative. Further discussion? Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I don't have a constitutional objection. I don't mean the document. I mean the internal deep opposition to photo radar. I did ask the local representative or one of the Salem representatives about their feeling, and they were opposed, and I felt sort of weird about it. It's not exactly imposing because I understand it gives them the option, but after that conversation, I'll be a no now, with reserving my option to be a flip flopper on the floor.
Is there further discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Weiner?
No.
Representative Smith?
No.
Representative Nathanson?
Aye.
Representative Lindsay?
Yes.
Vice Chair Beyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan?
Yes.
Chair Reed?
Aye.
And Chair Vance?
Aye. Motion carries, and we need a carrier, and I think Representative Comp is the one that brought this bill. So
I can carry it.
He's so
thank you,
today.
Representative. Very, very helpful. We'll remember that on Friday. I think I've closed the work session on that with Representative Comp being the carrier. So let me see, members of the committee. We have one bill left, House Bill 2919. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2919, and I'm going to hear from Representative Reed. Zach.
House Bill 2919 just authorizes veterans to be eligible under the boost account.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Tobias Reed, State Representative from District 27. House Bill 2919 is a very simple concept. Those of you who were here in our last session remember the Boost bill aimed at helping employers hire new people. We've, on further reflection and greater experience, noticed that there's an opportunity in the requirements for eligibility with Boost. Among those there are several components, and this bill simply says that if you're a veteran, you're eligible, notwithstanding the other provisions that are requirement that are required. The one that I think that it most directly affects is the requirement that the person be unemployed for 60 days or more. A veteran, particularly one who's returning from service elsewhere, might not have had that experience, but I think it's the view of the sponsors, or at least certainly mine, that we'd like to honor that service by allowing a veteran to be eligible for the Boost program, and that is the extent of the bill.
Thank you. Are there questions? Seeing none. We, I don't think we have anyone signed up to testify on this.
If we don't have anybody else, I would, if I could ask a quick question. Thanks, Mr. Chair. I apologize if this makes you repeat a little bit of what you said. So is right now that is what we're hoping to do, give a mild preference to veteran companies, or merely say that just because you don't have if you're a veteran and you lack a certain duration that otherwise you'd have, you know, the duration thing doesn't count against you if it's a veteran.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I think if I understood you, you had it right at the last.
Okay.
A veteran could be returning from service somewhere else and be missing the requirement they would otherwise have of being unemployed for 60 days or more.
Great.
This seeks to remedy that.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Further questions? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2919. Colleagues, we are ready to work House Bill 2919. So, is there a motion?
We need to be in a work session.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. And I'll open the work session on that. Now do I hear a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2919 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
It's been moved that House Bill 2919 pass the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Representative Lindsay.
I'll be a no on this. Primary purpose is that I think that Boost is bad policy. I've been around, been involved with it. I think Oregonian has reported heavily on it. And I think any way to continue it or institutionalize it is a bad idea. So I'll be a no.
Thank you. Further discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Nathanson.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Widener.
Aye.
Representative Lindsay.
No.
Vice Chair Byer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan.
Yes.
Chair Reed.
Aye.
Chair Vann.
Aye. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2919, and we're going to have about a one-minute recess.
We recess a lot. I love recess.
Back to order. We are going to carry over to Friday House Bill 2891. And I think, Zach, is there anything else left for us to do?
Can you carry on?
No, we just want to reaffirm.
Yes, we should. 2370. is carried over to 3613, is carried over to 3158, is carried over. And we're not going to continue. All right, unless the committee has anything to add, we will adjourn. Thank you, committee members, for your patience.
Well done. So, just as I asked you,